that it was a faith, it was a religion with her. David Silverman is
That's why I can't get into it, get behind it.
Well, but
or even like the show that's on the air now, you know? I mean, it's an alternate religion without religion.
Yeah, well, it's a new management. They have a new management. Now, when I read
I'm
about...
I'm not going to be a member of any club.
When anybody who, you know, causes Fox News to do shows against him is okay in my book, all right? You know, because, of course, he's head of the conspiracy to remove Christmas from the face of the map or something like that. Bah, humbug. Mm. And actually, to an extent, he is. But I'm sure he'd be willing, cheerfully agree with that. But having said that, he's a really nice guy. He's a charming fellow. And I like him. I like his kids. And his wife will be my guest at LunaCon.
I take it she's a writer.
She's editor of Space and Time magazine,
oh, that's right. Yeah.
Which is a small press magazine. And Barbara has a story coming out in there in 2 years. They have a very
backlog. Eh?
Oh yeah, they have a huge backlog.
They put it online. And it's not a magazine, I suppose.
No, it is a magazine if it's online. There are a lot of good magazines that are online only. Cross Genres, for example, I believe in its revived version is...
Only a minute till Hour of the Wolf starts,
ooh,
by the way.
Yeah, oh, by the way.
We should be playing promos now.
Yeah, that was mandated, was it? By the way, where are the new...
Because we don't have enough commercials on our non-commercial stations.
Where are the... We have months of commercials. Where are the new rules for Safe Harbor?
Were there some? The one they circulated was a 5-year-old document,
yes.
Right, wasn't it?
Yes, well, what happened was... Shall I tell the story on the air? Sure, I will. They circulated this document... about 3.5 weeks ago, and it was dated something like 2007, and it was from our FCC lawyer, John Krigler.
And he
wrote in there something that I've always maintained, that it is okay for us to honor and use Safe Harbor.
Except all the managers got together and decided otherwise.
Well, maybe so, but this memo was reissued. 3.5 weeks ago. And I took that to heart. And in fact, I wrote on the listserv and to WBAI management, I'm saying I'm so pleased to see that we are reinstituting Safe Harbor.
Oh, we are?
Well, I wrote this.
Oh, okay.
Wait, the story gets good. And
what the bleep did you do?
Oh, what the bleep I did was I had on my guest, Keith DeCandido. And Keith came in, and I got him on, by the way, like 6 hours notice. You see, 2 months before that, we're going to go shaggy dog here. 2 months before that, he was supposed to read at one of my readings at the New York Review of Science Fiction readings, and he had car failure. He did not show. So when I called him and I said, how do I do a show in 6 hours? He said, I think I'd better. So anyway... so I had Keith on, and he said, well, I've got this story in it, and I assume the usual radio things apply. And I said, no, actually, no, go right ahead and use the language in it. So I went on the air, and I read the memo on the air from our lawyer and the date that was sent out, and I read all the relevant portions about Safe Harbor, that 10 p.m. to 6 a.m., it's okay. And remember, I had sent a note to management about this. So I read it on the air, and then for the first time since the newbie managers had gotten together and issued a decree saying there is no Safe Harbor, making us the most conservative broadcast.
Except on Bloomsday, somehow.
Except on Bloomsday, right. I read that, and I did a disclaimer. You know, the following program contains frank language.
If you're offended by Frank Heller,
bleep off. Yeah, I did that. I did that with Frank Heller. Yes, yeah. Following program contains Frank Heller. Indeed. I did that thing. I read the disclaimer. I read the memo. Keith went ahead. He had at least five MFs. Ooh. He had where's the list? Where's the list? He had like at least yes, thank you. Oh, this is no longer numbered. They used to have numbers, so I could say number six. He used five number sixes. He used at least three number threes, and I don't know, you know, put an infinity sign next to number one here.
Okay.
You know, so he used the blank word.
Number seven shouldn't even be on the list.
No. As Carlin says, and remember.
Not only Carlin, but every comedian on television.
And not to, you know, blank my son says or something like that. I mean, remember, the list of seven words is not the FCC list.
Yeah.
The seven words belong to George Carlin. Not to the government. And we were screwed because it was played on a Saturday at 2 p.m. It was not because we didn't have freedom of speech. It was because it was issued at a time when children might be listening. And a, you know, five-year-old would not understand how a disclaimer works. And it was on an episode of Hour of the Wolf that Safe Harbor was tested and found true. I had on a guest by the name of Harlan. What's the last name?
Easelman.
Harlan Easelman, who had a news story that he'd read the night before that I recorded called Shatterday, which was later made into a TV version starring Bruce Willis, and A Twilight Zone, written, scripted by George R.R. Martin. I wonder what's happened to him. And the. And I timed it. The last curse word in the story, it was a 45-minute story, and the last curse word went by like 29 minutes in. I play the whole thing, but I make it so that the last curse word goes by at 5:59 a.m., right? So as of 6 a.m., although the story continued another 15 minutes, there were no language problems. By the next, this was a Friday morning. By the following Monday morning, I was suspended. The FCC was after us. The station's license at stake again. And all this.
For this or for something else?
For my broadcast.
Okay.
For my broadcast. And our lawyers, who were the same lawyers as the ones who fought the Carlin case, were ecstatic. They said, oh, this Ellison guy is great. He was the head of the Writers Guild of America. He had all these credentials. Harlan was ecstatic. I'm going to go to in front of the Supreme Court. I'm going to show that, you know, Justice Warren Burger where he can stuff his robes so the sun don't shine, blah, 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 blah. And the Justice Department advised the FCC, drop it. You're not going to get anywhere with this. And thus, the proof of the sanctity of Safe Harbor was established by an episode of Hour of the Wolf. Mm. And that sort of said, okay, 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. And you know, thus made it so. P.S. Harlan was annoyed. He was looking forward to the Harlan Ellison, the Carlin Ellison decision. He wanted that in the record books, but as a Supreme Court case. But anyway. So fast forward to 3.5 weeks ago,
right.
I play this thing on a Wednesday night, oh, just like now, and Wednesday night, Thursday morning, and that Thursday night, we have a staff meeting about the move. And I had missed the first one the week before, so I attended the second one. And who should show up for it but the executive director of the Pacifica Foundation, Summer Reese. And she is fast talker, smart, you know, really, you've met her, you've dealt with her?
Yeah.
I mean, she's really,
I discussed my union grievances with her, as a matter of fact.
Ooh, okay.
And it didn't do any more good than discussing them with the union, the manager, or anyone else.
Yeah. She's fast. You'll give her that.
Yes. Oh, yes.
She's fast and she's smart. And
one more thing that I like about her, but I'll leave that out.
Off the air. I want to hear it. She says, you know, the station
She smokes, Jim. She smokes. Oh, I've outed her now.
She
said, went downstairs and had a smoke together, and well, I said, okay.
That sounds charming. She seems like the type. She's from L.A. What difference does it make? Your lungs are dead anyway.
You know? That's true.
So she says to the room full of people, this week alone on the different Pacifica stations, there were at least three number sixes. She used the word.
We need more number fives, but you know.
Well, yes, but this was number six.
Used to be a lot more number fives. WPAI.
The MF one, and I raised my hand and I said,
"No,
that's
six." Okay.
And I said, "I'm not. You're not counting the five that I broadcast last night, right?" She looked at me. She said, "You didn't." I said, "Sure, I did. Absolutely." I have the email here to prove it. She said, yes, that was sent out. Do you have any idea how old that is? I said, yeah, it's about 6 or 7 years old. She said, Kriegler doesn't believe in that anymore.
Oh?
I said, really? She said, yeah. I said, well, you know what? I followed the rules. I read the thing on the air. I did a disclaimer. She said, what time of day was it? I said, 2 a.m. She went, burst her lips. Okay. You know, but she said, we're probably, you know, going to have to suspend you. I said, I obeyed all the rules. And she said, I probably shouldn't be telling this part of the story in the air. She said, how are we going to explain to the FCC that we sent out an outdated memo?
Well, you know.
She has a point.
Okay, but a greater point that we also shouldn't discuss on the air is, you know, until somebody tells the FCC, they don't know about it.
Well, there's that. And
now
and
you've blown your cover. Not
there we
only did
go.
You broadcast,
there.
But now you've told everyone you broadcast it.
Well, it was broadcast then. It's only just scrolled off the archive.
But
now.
Nobody was listening.
Well, that's the
now.
Yeah, not at this time exactly. So that actually was my since then.
But look, they've shot down, you know, all of these indecency things on TV.
Well, yes.
So, I mean, this is all old hat.
It's old hat, and this has all been dealt with on TV. But on TV, they've got money. Hmm. And we don't. We don't have any money unless somebody should call in at area code 516-620-3602 and pledge at least $25 to become a subscriber to WBAI. Outside of that, we have no money. Which is why we're moving with our tail between our legs to a college campus all the way uptown. I'm in southern Brooklyn, you know.
Yeah.
I don't mean Brooklyn South, southern Brooklyn. And, you know, this is over a two-hour each-way train ride in the middle of the night. So this is problematic, not to mention
I have not been there yet, so I haven't even timed out. I don't know how.
Well, Mike Sargent put a video online, as did
and didn't Sinead tell anyone.
McLaughlin. Yeah, he put out, he put out a link like 2 or 3 days ago.
I need to go look. Oh, after I told him, you know, as long as you've made the movie, why don't you tell people about it?
Oh, maybe that was it. Maybe that was what did it, yeah. And what you see there, and this was as of last Tuesday, it's like, well, here's where the control room will be.
Well, I hear someone went there yesterday, and it looks exactly the same as it did.
Yeah.
When the staff took the tour a week or two ago.
Well, I couldn't imagine that they were able to do that much since. I mean, it looks like a nice facility. It's just, you know, hell and creation to get there, not to mention the climb up Vinegar Hill, which everybody goes, oh, no! Although I've spoken to a couple of people that are very familiar with the campus, and they were shrugging, saying, it's not bad. Mm. But when I said, what about at 3:30 a.m., and they gave me a look saying, that can be a problem.
Yeah. Well, I won't be. I'll only be leaving at strange hours. I'll mostly be arriving at
Well, I would be
hours.
Leaving at about 3:30.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, unless something changes.
Well, Jim, as nice as it is, as pleasant as it is to sit here and exchange
chat.
Pleasantries... I actually need to produce two newscasts by 5 a.m., so I'm going to go back to the duties that called me here this evening.
Okay.
And leave you to Hour of the Wolf.
Okay, now since I'm actually going to be doing a live reading this morning, did you want me to actually... You're not going to recognize the name
Yeah, well,
of that thing. Do you want? I can put it into the computer here and find it for you.
Yeah. Figure it out. The problem is my disk is, you know, usually 2 or 3 gigabytes away from full at any time.
I can loan you one.
Yeah. Oh, actually, wait.
Are you ready?
You want some tech talk?
Sure.
Here for Christmas.
Here, 32 gig.
For Christmas, I bought, what is this one? This is 16 or 32.
Oh, okay.
So I'm looking online, and they say there's a new technique.
Well, this one's 16, this one's 32.
There's a new technique for formatting. And what's it called? Fat something. XFAT. Is it XFAT?
I have not heard of
it. It's made only, it's used only for thumb drives.
Okay.
And so I said, okay, well, it's supposed to be more efficient and, you know, you, blah, blah, blah. I looked it up. So I formatted it.
Uh-oh.
Works great on Windows 7.
Uh-huh.
Not backwards compatible, apparently, to Windows XP.
No, because, it wouldn't be.
Well, there you go.
It couldn't be.
So I can use this at home and on some machines around the station, but on the XP machines, it's totally useless.
Because Windows XP uses a... What is it called? Disk Operating System. Yeah. DOS. Windows XP sits on top of DOS.
Maybe I should partition
why? I mean, if it's 16 gigs, just use 16 gigs and be happy that you've got it.
Yeah, I suppose.
That's a fairly large amount of room.
Might even be 32. It says. Let's see. What does it say on here?
The one I've got is 32, and I can loan it.
Yeah, this is 32.
Oh, okay, fine.
But it's XFAT.
Oh, dear. Well, yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I could reformat it. I don't know if there's anything particular around here that I need.
Okay, the series is called Do Not Adjust Your Set.
Yes, that was it.
And it is 1.8 gigs.
And what about that?
For the whole series.
Oh. What was the thing, something about 1948, the greatest show of 1948, which apparently was just prior to Monty Python?
Something like that, yeah. The title is close to it, or it's the 1948 show, finally, something like that.
Yeah. But, you know, I'd love to see full versions of everything they showed little clips of on there.
Yeah.
Just a great show.
I was astonished at seeing Magical Mystery Tour, which I hadn't seen since sometime in the 70s.
I don't know if I've ever seen it.
It was broadcast recently on PBS. And of all things, when you get to, like, the last 10 minutes, John and George walk into a strip club. And performing at the strip club, singing Death Cab for Cutie, is the Bonzo Dog Band. It's the weirdest thing. And there's John and George sitting there while the Bonzo Dog Band...
And the guy who turned into Paul McCartney, according to some rumors.
Vivian Stanshall?
Yes, exactly.
Oh, jeez.
I'll show it to you. There's a transformation website where they show his face changing into Paul McCartney's face.
Okay, yeah, morphing software is fun.
The greatest Paul is Dead website in the world is some Italian website. You should look for it. It's fascinating.
Oh, okay.
Fascinating stuff.
And during Bonzo performing, there's a strip act going on, and I thought, well, it's like it was a Boxing Day show. It was a kids show, right? Broadcast on Boxing Day, and damn if it wasn't a complete striptease on TV. PBS didn't show it. I don't know if the BBC ever did. They probably did not. They had a little censored thing, sort of like, you know, the TV ads you see for Girls Gone Wild kind of thing. But that was about it, and it was like, whoa. And let me tell you, by the way, Magical Mystery Tour really, really sucks.
Yes, so I've
but
heard.
It is so much fun.
But who is it
watch.
On the bus? Is Stanshall on the bus also?
No.
I think he is.
I don't think so.
Well, you got to go to that Italian Paul is Dead site, though. Well, you'll see him. You'll see a picture of him.
They had a one-hour documentary on the making of with
right.
Sir Paul and Sir Richard and all these various, including a couple. It was charming, these middle-aged women, which is to say, you know, people of my age or whatever, who told about how they had these terrible jobs as clerics, and they had a choice to go, you know, to miss work for 2 days and be on the Magical Mystery Tour with the Beatles, mm-hmm. or to, keep on working. And they were threatened with being fired if they took those 2 days off. Well, they took the 2 days off, and they went on vacation with the Beatles, mm-hmm. as did about, I would say there's about 15 to 20 people in there, including some wonderful actors.
Yes, I've seen stills.
Yeah, but the it's worth seeing. I mean, it was only about a month ago that it was on PBS.
I missed it somehow.
It may very well be on their website.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised. It's certainly by now, for the first time ever, a DVD. With that and the making of.
Not on Netflix?
Not yet. Most PBS stuff... PBS is going between Netflix and Hulu Plus. Depending on which show and which deals they have going with whom. And by the way, I've started watching House of Cards. The second original Netflix.
There's a poster that I keep passing by for it.
Yeah.
But...
It's a remake of a BBC show that starred Ian
McKellen.
No, not Ian McKellen. A guy who's never played Ian Richardson.
Oh,
Ian Richardson, a wonderful actor who never played a good guy in his life, except maybe Midsummer Night's Dream, and even there he was Oberon. We're talking 1969 with the topless Judi Dench.
I'll never forget the topless Diana Rigg.
Oh, that was on Broadway.
Was it? I saw it on TV.
Ooh, what was that?
Midsummer Night's Dream, I believe.
Oh, that's not Diana. No, she's fully clothed in Midsummer Night's Dream.
Well, then
it's Judi Dench who's topless.
No,
she plays Titania.
You're not going to dissuade me. I saw what I saw back in the 70s.
You saw? Okay. This is on Netflix, as a matter of fact. It's David Warner, Ian Holm as Puck. An incredible cast. Ian Richardson, as mentioned, as Oberon. Felicity Kendall. Almost all of my favorites. Diana Rigg is one of the two young ladies, not the blonde, but the dark-haired one,
yes.
Who's always worried about the fact that she's not fair and that she's short. So, and that's the role that she plays. You're confusing her with the Queen of the Fairies.
I don't think so. I do not think so.
Well,
maybe it was a different production.
Well, if so, I'm sorry to have missed it. I did see Diana Rigg topless once on Broadway.
I don't know. This was on TV for
Ooh.
Sure. On TV on Channel 13, I'm sure it was.
Oh, and by the way, I don't know what's going on here, but I call up the browser and Google has a Ferris wheel or something.
Well, apparently, is it there? What is this, President's Day? Oh, Valentine's Day.
Oh, of course.
All the arrows are pointing at a heart. All right. Coming up on... It's getting close to 2 o'clock.
If he walks in properly, given the delay system, he will probably hear me. He was by the elevator when he waited.
Oh, is he leaving?
No, he's coming. It looked like he was coming in, actually.
Well, I got to be getting out
But
of
wait,
here.
Hold on 1 second. Let's deal with this... Diana Rigg issue, and issues involving Diana Rigg, particularly not fully clothed, are very important to me.
Okay. Well, she was wearing a sheer, so sheer you could see through it outfit.
Oh, that's vaguely credible. All the phones are, here ringing. Diana Rigg. And when I say the Avengers, I mean Diana Rigg in the Avengers.
Yes.
I don't mean, that Joss Whedon movie, which is pretty good.
No, this was shortly after she went off that show, maybe 1970-ish, I would say.
The Midsummer Night's Dream I'm thinking of is 67. Pretty sure. Let's see. Jump to actress. Oh, she's going to be in Game of Thrones, isn't she?
You know, I have
and
not
she's
seen
in Doctor
that.
Who. She's
I have not seen that yet.
I reserve I used to be good friends with George Martin. I love his work and all that, but I prefer his science fiction. I really do. I prefer
without all the head chopping.
Well, that's basically it. Yes, that's basically it. I don't need all the head chopping. I don't need. Let's see. I'll do a search on the word dream here. I don't need killing off the hero before the first season is even over.
Yeah.
Things like that. And no. Ooh. Okay. She did a Okay. She was Helena in 1968. So I was wrong about 1967. And if that's the same year that she left. The Avengers.
Well, the one I and saw then there's been a few years later.
Then there's a 1969. So she did two dreams.
And who is she in the second one?
I am trying to find out. It does not say.
I thought she was like the lead in the one I saw.
It only credits three people: Mike Apache, Rick Lubin, and Diana Rigg. And these other two people don't have photographs or anything. There is no information about that, no director. They have the name of the author. It's Shakespeare.
Where was that a TV thing? Does it say what it was produced for?
It does not say. It's on Wikipedia they would call it a stub. There is no information on it on IMDb at all. There is, however, full information on the one that I have been citing with Judi Dench as Titania. But Diana Rigg was Helena in that one. And yeah, they're wearing Athenian clothing, which is not exactly, you know, full whatever. Derek Godfrey, oh my God, it's this cast. David Warner, Diana Rigg, Helen Mirren, Bill Travers, Donald Eccles. I'm only giving Ian Richardson, as I said, as Oberon. Let's go to full cast and crew here, shall we? I mean, it was an all-star cast. It was directed by Peter Hall.
And this was theatrical or television?
This is television. This is BBC.
Yeah.
Really, really wonderful production. And yes, on Netflix. So you can see it there, and you know, you'll get to see somebody who was knighted naked.
That's the point, after all, isn't it?
Well, it was a good production. It was a good Shakespeare. I haven't seen a good Shakespeare. Well, you see, the reason I didn't come in till 12:30 is because I was busy watching Henry V on TV.
Not Richard III? I was watching him in a hole in the ground.
Richard III, no. Which Richard III? Talking about the Ian McKellen one?
No, I'm talking about the guy in the parking lot. You didn't hear this? They found the corpse.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
They found the real guy.
Found the real guy. Exactly, yeah. No,
with his skull
that's
cleaved.
No. Well, you see, I got confused because Henry V follows Richard II. We have Richard II, then you have Henry IV, part one, part two, and then Henry V. And together, these four plays make up The Hollow Crown, and they are going to be broadcast. They have already been on the BBC, starring, by the way, as Henry V in this new production, Tom Hiddleston. Uh-huh. The name doesn't do anything for you.
It does, but not enough that I can say, oh, him.
Loci.
Oh, of course, yes.
Brilliant actor. Amazing actor.
He does a great impression of Hans Gruber?
The villain, yes.
The villain from Die Hard?
Yeah. He does a good Alan Rickman there. He really does. And why wasn't Alan Rickman in The Avengers? He could choose scenery with the best of them. But Tom Hiddleston is a great actor, and when you see him in his Henry V, I think, well, in Henry IV, and, you know, parts one and two, in which he's hanging out with Falstaff, and then Henry V when he becomes king. And really, but it started with Richard II, where Henry IV, the soon-to-be Henry IV, kills Richard II and then worries about it for the next two plays. Hmm. And all of that is called The Hollow Crown.
Angst-ridden.
All of which is part of the War of the Roses, all of which then, and in history, accounts for the Hundred Years' War. I find this stuff incredibly confusing.
Yes.
But I do like the plays. And the Kenneth Branagh version of this, with Ian Holm, again, in a smaller role, but... it was Branagh as Henry V. That's a good production. It's a good... There hasn't been a bad one yet. I've seen the Olivier. I'm not always a big Olivier fan. The Branagh is wonderful, and now there's this one with Tom Hiddleston. So three Henry V's.
And where do we look forward to these?
I don't know. I do know that they were... They've already been broadcast on the BBC at the time of the Olympics, you know, as they were doing the whole patriotic thing. And it was through my usual BBC sources that I've only watched the Richard III. I started watching Henry IV, and the language was flying by so fast, with Jeremy Irons as Henry IV and Tom Hiddleston as Hal, the son. It was flying by so fast. I couldn't pick it up. But Channel 13 broadcast a series in conjunction with that, and for some reason they broadcast this first, explaining various Shakespearean plays, included with Jeremy Irons doing Henry IV and V. Great series. David Tennant explaining Hamlet.
Yes, I think I've heard of this.
Ethan Hawke.
Maybe from you.
I don't know. I mean, it just ended. It was a 6-part series. Yeah. On PBS, ended last week with David Tennant doing Hamlet and Trevor Nunn doing The Tempest. It was a brilliant, brilliant, wonderful series. Actors talking about creating the role, Ethan Hawke doing Macbeth, Patrick Stewart chewing the scenery. Really, really good stuff. Good stuff. Do you think I should take it?
I don't know. You know, we know it's not Monroe.
Yeah.
But it might be Monroe's replacement.
If it were Monroe, he'd be calling in to talk about February 11th, you know.
Oh, that's true. I saw that anniversary come and go.
Yeah, last Monday.
Who made note of that?
I did.
That must have been where I saw it. Would have gone by me.
And with any luck, maybe Fass will tomorrow night.
I think Fass was...
Oh, maybe he did
either
last
mentioned
week?
It last week, or somehow I saw it pop up.
I would hope so.
About how an unpleasant anniversary.
Halcyon days.
Speaking of the Olympics, what's this about there dropping wrestling? How is this possible?
Really?
It's one of the few original sports of the Olympics. How dare they?
That is sort of the entire basis. Now, I took this out to show you something online. I don't even remember what it was.
Show off.
Well, I'm not showing. This is the Nexus 7.
Okay. I can't keep them straight anymore. There's too damn many of them.
Well, this isn't a phone. This is a tablet. It doesn't dial up. There's no monthly fee or anything.
So it's an Android, I assume, as opposed to...
Yes. And being a Nexus, it's Android only with nothing else. No, you know, there's no phone service. There's no manufacturer stuff in it. It's the company that made this is called Google. Or actually, Asus manufactured it for Google, but it's a Google device. Mm. And as such,
this is... I gotta get me one of those someday.
They're really nice. They're not expensive. Here's an email from Berthold Reimers.
Jim, stop talking about what you're talking about and raise some money.
Okay. 917-379. Oh, there it is. 516-620-3602. And we're very serious because we, you know, if you listen to the subtext of what we're talking about, we're in, where's the list?
Oh, that list.
In deep number one, okay? We're in deep number one.
Oh, come on. You're taking a number two with me, as they say in England.
Indeed, yes. Yeah, I am totally number two'd off. But you see, you can say that. You can say that you're PO'd. But you cannot say that you are taking a number two. which actually would be a number one.
You're taking the
number one would be if you're taking a number one. Yeah, they really should. They really should. But that's not the order in which Carlin said them. You see, and that indeed is the point.
I thought the point was 516-620-3602.
Have you any premiums I should steal?
Well, I have my Black History premiums and a Gene Shepard premium. That's
the Gene Shepard is the one I would pitch.
Brand new.
And if there's any time after...
Here's one you might enjoy. Yes. The Ultimate Horror Library.
Ooh.
Two DVDs jam-packed with every horror radio program I could lay my hands on.
That you consider horror, yes.
Well,
classic horror, yeah.
Well, old-time radio horror, but also more recent stuff. I don't believe...
I mean, there was an episode of Alan's Alley that was so horrible.
No. But we do have some Canadian shows and South African shows and, you know, anywhere in the English-speaking world that wasn't produced by the BBC. And I took great care to excise any BBC
But I can't pitch that because it's not registered for this hour.
That's true, but they can get it online. They can get it at give2wbai online.
That's G-I-V-E,
or you can also use
number
PayPal
2 wbai.org.
That's right, G-I-V-E 2, number 2,
yeah.
wbai.org. It's in the miscellaneous section across the top, although I did finally convince them to change the music premium category to arts and music, or music and arts, or something that would be a little more all-encompassing. Because, you know, I don't know if Gene Shepard CDs belong with tote bags and hats and cell phone covers that we're now pushing every day.
Yeah.
You're getting your cell phone cover. Keep your head free from radiation.
I just have rubber on mine. This is
Nexus
3.
That may work on some things, but not on a cell phone.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's still controversial, isn't it? That whole question of that whole question of they did a test and one test said no, and it was not a cell phone company sponsored test, said no, the radiation is minor compared to just the radiation that you pick up from being in a room like this with a lot of electronics around is worse for you than talking on a cell phone for 12 hours or something like that. So it's controversial. On the other hand, it's not needless.
But safe than sorry.
Better safe than sorry.
And more to the point, it also concentrates the radio waves inside the phone, apparently, and saves the battery life.
Well, battery life on my phone, I have to say, really, really sucks.
Well, there you go.
I get like 3 hours on this thing.
Now, somehow,
which is why I carry.
This contains the energy and makes your battery last longer. That's one of the better claims.
That sounds like a tin foil kind of thing.
Hey, look, but it's a BAI premium. It probably is.
Oh, well, and there we go. I should celebrate Valentine's Day.
Well, you do. I have to go celebrate Al Jazeera Day.
Oh, you do.
Otherwise,
you do
the network
that.
Is going to, you know, 60 stations around the network are going to say, "Where's my news?" If I don't get busy.
Yeah, and never mind. okay, so you get busy with Al. Say hi to him for me.
Sir.
And I'm going to read a short story. By Robert Sheckley. But you know what? I should give myself a little... Max, could I ask of you a huge favor?
Such as?
Believe it or not, would you bring me a glass of water?
I don't know. I think they packed all the glasses.
They probably did. And I took my ZBS mug home.
I'll bring you a dirty mug of water.
Yeah, okay, thank you. And what I am going to do is I am going to play, a little belatedly, the opening to Hour of the Wolf. Just to give myself a break. No, I won't play the opening to Hour of the Wolf. I will play a song. What should I play here? Journey of the Sorcerer. Why not? We've been talking about BBC stuff. Journey of the Sorcerer by the Eagles. I think BBC friends and fanatics will enjoy it. Thank you. And by the way, let me mention, this is WBAI New York. Okay, well, I have my water, I have taken a break, and as we listen to Journey of the Sorcerers, let me tell you about one of my favorite all-time science fiction writers, Robert Sheckley. He wrote the following story in 1957 for his collection Notions Unlimited, but and most of his stuff is sadly out of print. But this is almost a perfect Valentine's Day story. And it is entitled The Language of Love. Jefferson Toms went into an auto cafe one day after classes to drink coffee and study. He sat down, philosophy tests piled neatly before him, and saw a girl directing the robot waiters. Oh, yes, let me issue a disclaimer. Disclaimer of a different time. This story was written in 1957. It uses the G-word, girl, to refer to what we would today call women. Okay. She had smoky gray eyes and hair the color of a rocket exhaust. Her figure was slight but sweetly curved, and gazing at it, Toms felt a lump in his throat and a sudden recollection of autumn, evening, rain, and candlelight. And this is how love came to Jefferson Toms. Although he was ordinarily a very reserved young man, he complained about the robot service in order to meet her. When they did meet, he was inarticulate, overwhelmed by feeling. Somehow, though, he managed to ask her for a date. The girl, whose name was Doris, was strangely moved by the stocky, black-haired young student, for she accepted at once. And then Jefferson Tom's troubles began. He found love delightful, yet extremely disturbing in spite of his advanced studies in philosophy. But love was a confusing thing even in Tom's age, when spaceliners bridged the gaps between the worlds, disease lay dead, war was inconceivable, and just about anything of any importance had been solved in an exemplary manner. Old Earth was in better shape than ever before, her cities bright with plastic and stainless steel, her remaining forests were carefully tended bits of greenery where one might picnic in perfect safety, since all beasts and insects had been removed to sanitary zoos, which reproduced their living conditions with admirable skill. Even the climate of Earth had been mastered. Farmers received their quota of rain between 3 and 3:30 in the morning. People gathered at stadiums to watch a program of sunsets, and a tornado was produced once a year in a special arena as part of the World Peace Day celebration. But love was as confusing as ever, and Tom's found this distressing. He simply could not put his feelings into words. Such expressions as, "I love you," "I adore you," "I'm crazy about you," were overworked and inadequate. They conveyed nothing of the depth and fervor of his emotions. Indeed, they cheapened them, since every stereo, every second-rate play was filled with similar words. People used them in casual conversation, spoke how much they loved pork chops, adored sunsets, were crazy about tennis. Every fiber of Tom's being revolted against this. Never, he swore, would he speak of his love in terms used for pork chops. But he found, to his dismay, that he had nothing better to say. He brought the problem to his philosophy professor. "Mr. Tom's," the professor said, gesturing warily with his glasses, "love, as it is commonly called, is not an operational area with us as yet. No significant work has been done in this field aside from the so-called language of love from the Tyanian race." Well, this was no help. Tom's continued to muse on love and think lengthily of Doris. In the long, haunted evenings on her porch when the shadows from the trellis vines crossed her face, revealing and concealing it, Tom struggled to tell her what he felt. And since he could not bring himself to use the weary commonplaces of love, he tried to express himself in extravagances. I feel about you," he would say, "the way a star feels about its planet." "How immense," she would answer, immensely flattered at being compared to anything cosmic. "Well, that's not what I meant," Tom's amended. "The feeling I was trying to express was more, well, for example, when you walk, I am reminded of a what? A doe in a forest glade," said Tom's, frowning. "That's charming." No, it wasn't intended to be charming. I was trying to express the awkwardness inherent in youth. And yet, "But honey," she said, "I'm not awkward. My dancing teacher's not." No. I didn't mean awkward. But the essence of awkwardness is... "I understand," she said. But Tom's knew she didn't. So he was forced to give up extravagances. Soon he found himself unable to say anything of any importance to Doris, for it was not what he meant, not even close to it. The girl became concerned at the long, moody silences which developed between them. "Jeff," she would urge, "surely you can say something." Tom's shrugged his shoulders. "Well, even if it isn't absolutely what you mean..." Tom sighs. "Please," she cried, "say anything at all. I can't stand this." "Oh, hell." "Yes," she breathed, her face transfigured. "But that wasn't what I meant," Tom said, relapsing into gloomy silence. At last he asked her to marry him. He was willing to admit that he loved her, but he refused to expand on it. He explained that a marriage must be founded upon truth, or it is doomed from the start. If he cheapened and falsified his emotions at the beginning, what could the future hold for them? Doris found his sentiments admirable, but refused to marry him. "You must tell a girl that you love her," she declared. "You have to tell her that 100 times a day, Jefferson, and even then it's not enough." "But I do love you," Tom's protested. "I mean to say, I have an emotion corresponding..." "Oh, Jeff, stop it!" In this predicament, Tom's thought about the language of love and went to his professor's office to ask about it. "Well, we are told," his professor said, "that the race indigenous to Tyana II had a specific and unique language for the expression of sensations of love. To say, 'I love you,' was unthinkable for Tyanians. They would use a phrase denoting the exact kind and class of love that they felt at that specific moment and used for no other purpose." Tom's nodded, and the professor continued. Of course, developed with this language was necessarily a technique of lovemaking, quite incredible in its perfection. We are told that it made all ordinary techniques seem like the clumsy pawing of a grizzly in heat. The professor coughed in embarrassment. But that is precisely what I need, Tom's exclaimed. Ah, ridiculous, said the professor. The technique might be interesting, but your own is doubtless sufficient for most needs, and the language, by its very nature, can be used with only one person. To learn it impresses me as wasted energy. Labor for love, Tom said, is the most worthwhile work in the world, since it produces a rich harvest of feeling. I refuse to stand here and listen to bad epigrams. Mr. Toms, why all this fuss about love? It's the only earnest, perfect thing in this world, Toms answered fervently. If one must learn a special language to appreciate it, one can do no less. Tell me, is it far to Tyana, too? A considerable distance, his professor said with a thin smile, and an unrewarding one, since the race is extinct. Extinct? But why? A sudden pestilence, an invasion? It is one of the mysteries of the galaxy, his professor said somberly. Then the language is lost. Well, not quite. 20 years ago, an Earthman named George Varus went to Tyana and learned the language of love from the last remnants of the race. The professor shrugged his shoulders. I never considered it sufficiently important to read his scientific papers. Toms looked up Varus in the Interspatial Explorer's Who's Who and found that he was credited with the discovery of Tyana, had wandered around the frontier planets for a time, but at last he had returned to deserted Tyana to devote his life to investigating every aspect of its culture. After learning this, Toms thought long and hard. The journey to Tyana was a difficult one, time-consuming and expensive. Perhaps Varus would be dead before he could get there, or unwilling to teach him the language. Was it worth the gamble? Is love worth it? Toms asked himself, and knew the answer. So he sold his Ultrafy, his memory recorder, his philosophy texts, and several stocks his grandfather had left him, and booked passage to Cranthus IV, which was the closest he could come to Tyana on a scheduled spaceway. And after all his preparations had been made, he went to Doris. When I return, he said, I will be able to tell you exactly how much, I mean the particular quality and class of, I mean, Doris, when I have mastered the Tyanian technique, you'll be loved as no woman has ever been loved. Do you mean that? She asked, her eyes glowing. Well, Tom said, the word love doesn't quite express it, but I mean something very much like it. I will wait for you, Jeff, she said, but please, don't be too long. Jefferson Toms nodded, blinked back his tears, clutched Doris inarticulately, and hurried to the spaceport. Within the hour, he was on his way. 4 months later, after considerable difficulties, Tom stood on Tyana, on the outskirts of the capital city. Slowly he walked down the broad, deserted main thoroughfare. On either side of him, noble buildings soared to dizzy heights. Peering inside one, Tom saw complex machinery and gleaming switchboards. With his pocket Tyana English dictionary, he was able to translate the lettering above one of the buildings. It read, Counseling Services for Stage 4 Love Problems. Other buildings were much the same, filled with calculating machinery, switchboards, ticker tapes, and the like. He passed the Institute for Research into Affection Delay, stared at the 200-story Home for the Emotionally Retarded, and glanced at several others. Slowly, the awesome, dazzling truth dawned upon him. Here was an entire city given over to the research and aid of love. Yet no time for further speculation. In front of him was the gigantic General Love Services building, and out of its marble hallway stepped an old man. "Who the hell are you?" the old man asked. "I am Jefferson Toms of Earth. I have come here to learn the language of love, Mr. Varus." Varys raised his shaggy white eyebrows. He was a small, wrinkled old man, stoop-shouldered and shaky in the knees. But his eyes were alert and filled with a cold suspicion. "Perhaps you think the language will make you more attractive to women," Varys said. "Don't believe it, young man. Knowledge has its advantages, of course, but it has distinct drawbacks, as the Tyanians discovered." "What drawbacks?" Toms asked. Varys grinned, displaying a single yellow tooth. "You wouldn't understand if you don't already know. It takes knowledge to understand the limitations of knowledge." "Nevertheless," Toms said, "I want to learn the language." Varys stared at him thoughtfully. "It is not a simple thing, Toms. This language of love and its resultant technique is every bit as complex as brain surgery or the practice of corporation law. It takes work, much work, and a talent as well." "I will do the work, and I'm sure I have the talent." "Most people think that," Vera said, "and most of them are mistaken. But never mind, never mind. It's been a long time since I've had company. We'll see how you get on, Toms." Together, they went into the General Services building, which Varys called his home. They went to the main control room, where the old man had put down a sleeping bag and set up a camp stove. There, in the shadow of the giant calculators, Tom's lessons began. Varys was a thorough teacher. In the beginning, with an aid of a portable semantic differentiator, he taught Toms to isolate the delicate apprehension one feels in the presence of a to-be-loved person, to detect the subtle tensions that come into being as the potentiality of love draws near. These sensations, Toms learned, must never be spoken of directly, for frankness frightens love. They must be expressed in simile, metaphor, and hyperbole, half-truths and white lies. With these, one creates an atmosphere and lays a foundation for love. And the mind, deceived by its own predisposition, thinks of booming surf and raging sea, mournful black rocks and fields of green corn. "Nice images," Toms said admiringly. "Well, those were samples," Varys told him. "Now you must learn them all." So Toms went to work, memorizing great long lists of natural wonders, to what sensations they were comparable, at what stage they appeared in the anticipation of love. The language was thorough in this regard. Every state or object in nature for which there was a response in love anticipation had been catalogued, classified, and listed with suitable modifying adjectives. When he had memorized the list, Varys drilled him in perceptions of love. Toms learned the small, strange things that make up a state of love. Some were so ridiculous that he had to laugh. The old man admonished him sternly. "Love is a serious business, Toms. You seem to find some humor in the fact that love is frequently predisposed by wind speed and direction." "Well, it seems foolish," Toms admitted. "There are stranger things than that," Varys said, and mentioned another factor. Tom shuddered. No, I can't believe that. "It's preposterous. Everyone knows. If everyone knows how love operates, why hasn't somebody reduced it to a formula? Murky thinking, Toms. Murky thinking is the answer, and an unwillingness to accept cold facts. If you cannot face it..." "I can face anything," Tom said, "if I have to. Please, let us continue." As the weeks passed, Toms learned the words which expressed the first quickening of interest, shade by shade, until an attachment is formed. He learned what that attachment really is and the three words that express it. This brought him to the rhetoric of sensation, where the body becomes supreme. Here the language was specific instead of elusive and dealt with feelings produced by certain words and, above all, by certain physical actions. A startling little black machine taught Toms the 38 separate and distinct sensations which the touch of a hand can engender, and he learned how to locate that sensitive area no larger than a dime, which exists just below the right shoulder blade. He learned an entirely new system of caressing, which caused impulses to explode, even implode along the nerve paths, and to shower colored sparks before the eyes. He was also taught the social advantages of conspicuous desensitization. He learned many things about physical love that he had dimly suspected, and still more things which no one had suspected. It was intimidating knowledge. Toms had imagined himself to be at least an adequate lover. Now he found he knew nothing, nothing at all, and that his best efforts had been comparable to the play of amorous hippopotami. "Well, what else could you expect?" Varys asked. "Good love-making, Toms, calls for more study, more sheer intensive labor than any other acquired skill. Do you still wish to learn?" "Definitely," Toms said. "Why, when I'm an expert on love-making, I can't. That's no concern of mine," the old man stated. "Let's return to our lessons." Next, Toms learned the cycles of love. Love, he discovered, is dynamic, constantly rising and falling, and doing so in definite patterns. There are 52 major patterns, 306 minor patterns, 4 general exceptions, and 9 specific exceptions. Toms learned them better than his own name. He acquired the uses of the tertiary touch, and he never forgot the day he was taught what a bosom was really like.
"But I can't say that," Toms objected, appalled.
"Well, it's true, isn't it?" Varys insisted.
"No, I mean, yes, I suppose it is, but it's unflattering."
"Yeah, so it seems. But examine, Toms, is it actually unflattering?" Toms examined and found that the compliment that lies beneath the insult, and so he learned another facet of the language of love. Soon, he was ready for the study of the apparent negations. He discovered that for every degree of love, there is a corresponding degree of hate, which is in itself a form of love. He came to understand how valuable hate is, how it gives substance and body to love, how even indifference and loathing have their place in the nature of love. Varys gave him a 10-hour written examination, which Toms passed with superlative marks. He was eager to finish, but Varys noticed that a slight tick had developed in his student's left eye, and his hands had a tendency to shake. "You need a vacation," the old man informed him. Toms had been thinking this himself. You may be right," he said with barely concealed eagerness. "Suppose I go to Cythera 5 for a few weeks." Varys, who knew Cythera's reputation, smiled cynically. "Eager to try out your new knowledge? Well, why not? Knowledge is to be used only after it is mastered. But I have mastered it. And couldn't we call this field work, a thesis, perhaps?" "No thesis is necessary," Varys said.
"But damn it all," Toms exploded. "I should do a little experimentation. I should find out for myself how all of this works, especially approach 33 CV. I mean, it sounds fine in theory, but I've been wondering, how does it work in actual practice? There's nothing like direct experience, you know, in order to reinforce." "Did you journey all this way to become a super seducer?" Varys asked with evident disgust.
"Well, of course not," Tom said, "but a little experimentation when your knowledge of the mechanics of sensation would be barren unless you understand love as well. You have progressed too far to be satisfied with mere thrills."
Toms, searching his heart, knew this to be true, but he set his jaw stubbornly.
"I'd like to find out that for myself, too." "You may go," Varys said. "But don't come back. No one will accuse me of loosing a callous scientific seducer upon the galaxy."
"All right, to hell with it. Let's get back to work."
"No! Look at yourself. A bit more unrelieved studying, young man, and you will lose the capacity to make love, and wouldn't that be a sorry state of affairs?"
Toms agreed that it certainly would be.
"I know the perfect spot," Varys told him, "for relaxation from the study of love."
They entered the old man's spaceship and journeyed 5 days to a small, unnamed planetoid. When they landed, the old man took Toms to the bank of a swift-flowing river where the water ran fiery red with green diamonds of foam.
The trees that grew on the banks of that river were stunted and strange, and colored vermilion. Even the grass was unlike grass or was orange and blue. How alien, gasped Toms. It is the least human spot I have found in this humdrum corner of the galaxy, Varys explained, and believe me, I've done some looking. Tom stared at him, wondering if the old man was out of his mind. But soon he understood what Varys meant. For months he had been studying human reactions and human feelings, and surrounding it all was the now suffocating feeling of soft human flesh. He had immersed himself in humanity, studied it, bathed in it, eaten and drunk and dreamed it. It was a relief to be here, where the water ran red and the trees were stunted and strange and vermilion, and the grass was orange and blue, and there was no reminder of Earth. Toms and Varys separated, for even each other's humanity was a nuisance. Toms spent his days wandering along the river's edge, marveling at the flowers which moaned when he came near them. At night, three wrinkled moons played tag with each other, and the morning sun was different from the yellow sun of Earth. At the end of a week, refreshed and renewed, Toms and Varys returned to Jacel, the Tyanian city dedicated to the study of love. Toms was taught the 506 shades of love proper, from the first faint possibility to the ultimate feeling, which is so powerful that only 5 men and 1 woman have experienced it, and the strongest of them survived less than an hour. Under the tutelage of a bank of small interrelated calculators, he studied the intensification of love. He learned all of the 1,000 different sensations of which the human body is capable, how to augment them and how to intensify them until they became unbearable, and how to make the unbearable bearable, and finally pleasurable, at which point the organism is not far from death. And that, Varys said one day, is everything. Everything? Yes, Toms. The heart has no secrets from you, nor, for that matter, has the soul or mind or the viscera. You have mastered the language of love. Now, return to your young lady. I will, Tom said. At last, she will know. Drop me a postcard, Varys said. Let me know how you're getting on. I'll do that, Tom's promised. Fervently, he shook his teacher's hand and departed for Earth. At the end of the long trip, Jefferson Toms hurried to Doris's home. Perspiration beaded his forehead and his hands were shaking. He was able to classify the feeling as stage 2 anticipatory tremors with mild masochistic overtones. But that didn't help. This was his first field work and he was nervous. Had he mastered everything? He rang the bell. She opened the door, and Tom saw that she was more beautiful than he had remembered, her eyes smoky gray and misted with tears, her hair the color of a rocket exhaust, her figure slight but sweetly curved. He again felt the lump at his throat and sudden memories of autumn, evening, rain, and candlelight. I'm back, he croaked. Oh, Jeff, she said very softly. Oh, Jeff. Tom simply stared, unable to say a word. It's been so long, Jeff, and I kept wondering if it was all worth it. Now I know. You know? Yes, my darling, I waited for you. I'd wait 100 years or 1,000. I love you, Jeff. She was in his arms. Now tell me, Jeff, she said. Tell me! And Toms looked at her and felt and sensed, searched his calculations, selected his modifiers, checked and double-checked. After much searching and careful selection and absolute certainty in allowing for his present state of mind and not forgetting to take into account climatic conditions, phases of the moon, wind speed and direction, sunspots, and other phenomena which have their due effect upon love, he said, "My dear, I am rather fond of you." Jeff, surely you can say more than that. The language of love. The language is damnably precise, Tom said wretchedly. I'm sorry, The phrase, I am rather fond of you, expresses precisely what I feel. Oh, Jeff. Yes, he mumbled. Oh, damn you, Jeff. There was, of course, a painful scene and a very painful separation. Tom's took to traveling. He held jobs here and there, working as a riveter at Saturn Lockheed, a wiper on the Helg Venos trader, a farmer for a while in a kibbutz on Israel 4. He bummed around the inner Dalmanian system for several years, living mostly on handouts. Then, at Novilo Sessile, he met a pleasant brown-haired girl, courted her, and in due course married her and set up housekeeping. Their friends say that the Tomses are tolerably happy, though their home makes most people uncomfortable. It is a pleasant enough place, but the rushing Red River nearby makes people edgy. And who can get used to vermilion trees and orange and blue grass and moaning flowers and three wrinkled moons playing tag in the alien sky? Tom likes it, though, and Mrs. Toms is, if nothing else, a flexible young lady. Toms wrote a letter to his philosophy professor on Earth saying that he had solved the problem of the demise of the Tyanian race, at least to his own satisfaction. The trouble with scholarly research, he wrote, is the inhibiting effect it has upon action. The Tyanians, he was convinced, had been so preoccupied with the science of love that after a while they just didn't get around to making any. And eventually, he sent a postcard, a short postcard, to George Veris. He simply said that he was married, having succeeded in finding a girl for whom he felt quite a substantial liking. Lucky devil, Veris growled after reading the card. Vaguely enjoyable was the best I could ever find. Well, I'm sorry, I just can't continue with that breaking up. Let's try it like this. This sounds better. But I'll tell you that you were listening to The Language of Love by Robert Sheckley. This is a band with a few things to say on that topic.
Say, but you can learn how to play the game. It's easy. Nothing you can make that can't be made. No one you can save that can't be saved. Nothing you can do, but you can learn how to be you in time.
Happy Valentine's Day, by the way. And if you'd like to call up and discuss The Language of Love by Robert Sheckley or other things that we've been discussing, the telephone number here to talk on the air is area code 917-580-6020. Or if, God forbid, you should want to pledge and support WBAI, that's 516-620-3602. But to talk on the air, 917-580-6020.
I still believe all you need is love, you know, but I don't believe that just saying it is going to do it, you know. I mean, I still believe in the fact that love is what we all need.
And it was for love. It was for love and bloody peace again, you know. It was a fabulous time.
Cheeky. And you're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, vibrating 99.5 million times every second. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. It is a pitching week, the last pitching week for the overnights. So I do implore that you give a pledge at 516-620-3602. And to talk on the air, as mentioned, 917-580-6020. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning.
Good morning.
The Jewish legend to which you referred.
Yes, thank you.
Is the Lamed Vovnik.
That's
36
it.
Righteous men.
That's it. 36 righteous men. That is
Lamed Vovnik. Now, apparently, this has been anthologized a lot. Howard Schwartz has at least 3 retellings in 3 of his collections, including Gabriel's Palace and Other Mystical Tales. It is included in Lewis Ginsburg's Legends of the Jews. And apparently, the question is, have they ever found the 36? Because apparently, when you find the 36, that opens up the gates so the Messiah comes. Only when there's 36.
I think that is a variant.
Yeah, but you might check with Barbara.
Yeah. Yeah, no, she's done some studying on this.
The righteous men? Yes. And
yes.
You're right, they don't know each other.
No, they cannot know each other, as
a
matter of fact.
They can't know each other.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, that is part of the entire premise. And if there are ever less than the 36 on Earth, that is the end of the Earth.
That's
is
right.
One variant on it. Another one is that, yes, when they're exactly 36, that will be the coming of the Messiah, and so on and so forth. So there are themes and variations. It's a great and wonderful legend.
It is.
A lot of fun.
It.
Yeah.
I think I've got about like 18 different variants of it, because I say it's been anthologized a lot. By the way,
but from what Max was saying, I mean, it sounds like this TV show with Kiefer Sutherland is a variant on that theme.
Now, which show was this?
It's whatever show is starring Kiefer Sutherland.
Oh,
I don't know.
I see.
Max and I were talking about.
Oh, well, that's interesting. By the way, Lunacon is the third weekend, 15th to the 17th. I had a thought for you. You were once talking about you would love to see Tom Bombadil have his own movie, and I'm curious.
I said that in passing, yes.
Well, no. I would, too, because I find him an absolute – the more I read – or the more I think about him, he is a character of which there is much more than meets the eye.
Oh, yes, and Tolkien did write an entire tale
of
Tom Bombadil. And he is probably, I think, he and Beorn are probably the two most interesting Tolkien characters. Elrond comes close, but
yeah.
Tom Bombadil is it. He was the first.
Yeah, well, the oldest and fatherless, as Elrond calls him.
Yes.
It occurred to me, because I located 2 books at Mid-Manhattan recently, one of which is the Tales from Perilous Realms, which is all the collected fairy stories of fairy, including Smith of Wooton Major, Farmer Giles. The first story he wrote for one of his sons, Rover Random, about a toy dog. But the other book I located was The Children of Húrin, and it occurred to me, you think you would like to see Peter Jackson stray into the area of perhaps doing a movie really based on the Elder Tales themselves? I would because I'm reading The Children of Horan, which is a very tragic tale.
I don't know. I have to say that I think that Peter Jackson has already dropped the ball.
Oh, you think you don't think he can go any further than he's done with The Hobbit?
No, I think he's gone too far.
You go, oh, well, yes. Well,
plain and simple. He should have made The Hobbit after Lord of the Rings. If he wanted to take a year off or something, that's fine.
Why did he wait
years? But then he went and he made King Kong. Who cares?
Yeah, well.
And then he made the Something Bones, The Lonely Bones. And again, who cares? He had created something. He did a fairly decent job with it. But I would have to say not a not a superb job. It's missing a lot of what it ought to have had. And by the way, I recently sat through and marveled mostly at the extended version of all three movies. I did it over three nights. And this is the extended version, you know, in which Return of the King is well over 4 hours long. So
you mean the extended beyond
The extended edition. It's called the extended edition. Not beyond anything. It is the extended edition.
Okay.
And having done that, I see the wonder and the lacking again in a number of the things that he did. He did a very, very, very good but not utterly superb job. There are superb details, but, you know, he should have let Tolkien be Tolkien as it is. You don't kill off Saruman.
Right.
By the way, and you should, by the way, pronounce it correctly. Getting little things like the culture, getting the language correctly. If Tolkien is all about
language and culture,
exactly. What's the word? Not semantics. He's a philologist.
Yes.
At any rate, and the reason that he went into these realms was for the purpose of the language, then you darn well better get the language right, and Jackson didn't. But that's not even half the point. You then take the first book in the series. Lord of the Rings came, 20 years later?
Yes.
The first book in the series that it all began from 1937, 180 pages long, written for young people. It is not a sophisticated book, although for a children's book, it has a quite nice depth. And to turn that into what will ultimately be 9 hours of cinema? No, that's wrong. It's, I saw the 3.5 hour part one of this epic, and while it was never boring exactly, it wasn't The Hobbit. It wasn't. Now, the casting is superb, the special effects are fine, but there is absolutely no reason why Radagast shows up, why we're spending all this time with Saruman, why
Galadriel
elf, is hanging out with the river elves. They don't get along. And, and it is just
it's not a children's movie.
No, it's not a children's movie. He's made it a prequel to Lord of the Rings and making it 2/3 of the length of Lord of the Rings when in fact it's 1/10 of the length.
Well, maybe I take it back. Maybe he shouldn't do the Elder Tale. By the way, interesting. You know, The Hobbit was published.
Maybe it's time for Del Toro to take over, as he was going to do The Hobbit.
He was? Oh. You know,
Jackson wasn't the original director of this movie.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes. History here.
The Hobbit was published in 1937 on the 21st of September, which is interestingly ironic and perhaps more than a thing, because it turns out that in The Hobbit, and this I did not find out or did not realize, both Bilbo and Frodo's birthdays are September 22nd.
Yes.
And
let's move along, because I want to take another couple of calls, and I've got 3 minutes.
Okay, so take another one. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye. And good morning. There we are. You're on the air. Hello.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
talking to me?
I am talking to you. Please turn down your radio. Okay. You're on the radio.
I can barely hear you, so that's why. I'm sorry. I was calling, wanting to call the pledge line.
Okay, well, that telephone number is area code 516-620-3602.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. And thank you for calling the pledge line, by the way. That's much, much appreciated. Okay, I'm sorry. I had three other calls coming in, and now, well, this is our system. They're all gone. By the way, during the course of this show, I see an email from the station manager. It says, "Dear all, Friday at midnight is our last broadcast at 120 Wall Street. Please stand by to get instructions from Tony Ryan concerning your assignment." Does not bode well, I must say, because from what I understand, we're not set up yet at the CCNY studios. They are not ready to broadcast. So I have a feeling that this is going to be a little bit like I was talking about with Max earlier, a betwixt and between kind of thing, like it was during Hurricane Sandy when we were washed out of this building. And this time we're going to be out of this building for other reasons. I do believe, given these strange words, your assignment, that I should be on the air next week. And I believe I'm going to be doing not only my own show, but also I'll be filling in on Burn Baby Burn Clapper. If either of these shows exist, I will be in that slot, apparently either out of CCNY. It may turn out that I may have to pre-record. I don't know. Nobody seems to know anything yet. Now you know as much as I do, having read you that mysterious email. Do let me tell you that you can visit my website, ourwolf.com, H-O-U-R-W-O-L-F. And if it looks like it's from another century, well, it is. It's from another millennium. It's a very mid-90s website, but it is more or less up to date with information. And you can also find the Hour of the Wolf group on Facebook, if you happen to swing that way. I myself prefer the web over Facebook, but Facebook is a centerpiece for a great many people, so I am there in both the guise of Hour of the Wolf and as well as NYRSF, NYRSF Readings. That's the reading series I produce. And by the way, the next one, which will be Wednesday, March 6th, will be with Ken Liu, that's L-I-U, great writer, and another wonderful writer, Robin Wasserman. And they are going to be reading selections from Oz Reimagined, edited by Douglas Cohen and John Joseph Adams, who will be co-hosts that evening. So for more information, well, you know, go to my website or to Facebook. I haven't put that on either yet, but it will be there shortly, hopefully by the end of the weekend. If you care to write me, please feel free to do so. I am Jim at ourwolf.com. H-O-U-R-W-O-L-F. If you want to do the formal name, it's J. Freund, but I also have a shortening, Jim at ourwolf.com. And basically, outside of that, I hope to be talking to you next week. Not sure. Uncertain times, but we should be progressing, hopefully. We're a progressive radio station, aren't we now? Thank you all for listening. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming on these airwaves in just a couple of moments. In the meantime, try to stay warm and dry. Good morning.
where the red, white, and blue spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth that's off the way I see it? Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works. Jerk, my people, the people all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. Wake up to the lies the pigs make up. Imperialistic swans that I grind into bacon bits. Call the fist cause I ain't taking. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison cause I'm busy attacking the flag. I ragging and snagging and dragging and rip it to shreds cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy. I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Made up this new rule and I want y'all
99 single list alive, WBAI, 120 Wall Street for the last time, so they say. 5 minutes after 3 o'clock, this is how we do it. Jimmy Cliff, Jimmy Cliff, Jimmy Cliff, Jimmy Cliff, Jimmy Cliff got the Grammy. This group did not get the Grammy, but Jimmy Cliff got the Grammy for his album called Rebirth. This group, just like Sinead O'Connor, got ripped off. Never got the Grammy, but put out the best, the best, the best reggae music, JBB. Bruno Mars stole the show, y'all. Yeah. Smoked Ziggy. Whoa. And his brother, Damien. Group got ripped off. Everlasting on this night, much is given, and we're taking every. This group got ripped off at the Grammys. We look upon the purest fields of green. When looking for the earthly reasoning, we come across a new discovery. In these the last hours of day, how fortunate we were just to have this time. We always looking for. like to dedicate this song to Scotty, man behind Jamala. Yeah. JBB, the group that was ripped off. JBB, the group that was ripped off at the Grammys. 99 Sinker List Alive right here. 10 minutes after the hour, 10 minutes after the hour. Mix me, Lista, mix me. 10 minutes after the hour, 3 o'clock right here. This is Burn, Baby Burn, where we burn the imperialist flag to ashes before 5 o'clock. Free speech radio news kicks in at 5 o'clock on the dot. Punto enseguida, por favor, para ti. Right here at WBAI 99 Sinker List Alive, yeah. Hey, this is the Begathon. You love what you hear. This is the premium of all premiums. It's more than affordable right here. $25 will get us off the mark at 516-620-3602. Just for you. Repite, por favor. Numero uno. 516-631-3602. Ring, 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 ring. Click, 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 click. WBAI.RG. You can do the instant into the coffers of WBAI Pacifica Radio at its best. If you're in Shibuya Station in Nippon, or if you're in Brixton in England, you know, London, yo, where I say, 516-620-3602. We need five ring-a-ding-ding right here at the $25 level, the affordable level. This is what you do. You call them up and say, yo, 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 kind of low like you and low with the money thing. Can you give me 25 days to pay $25? Can you give me 25 weeks to pay $25? Can you give me 12 months to pay the $25? But hook me up, hook me up, hook me up.